Okay, welcome back to the first segment of the Investigative Journal on the Republic Broadcasting Network. And we 2 hours isn't going to be enough, so I got to get right to my guest. As I said at the top of the show, we're under a red alert on the Investigative Journal for the next 90 days. This is a critical period in our life, and I got an echo on this. Kelly, can you get that down? I got an echo. Okay, that's better. Thank you. And I want to introduce my guest. His name is Captain Eric May, and he served in the 1st Cavalry Division in the U.S. Chemical Corps from 1977 to 1980. He's got a long and storied career in the military, a technical guy who's worked in a number of different areas in the military, rose to the rank of captain, and also has been in the private sector working in the media, doing many different things. His articles have appeared in the Houston Chronicle, among other places. And at this time, I want to introduce Captain Eric May. Are you with us, Captain? Captain.
Well, it's great to be here, although these aren't great times. I think you're well advised to have this being a critical window, the next 90 days. But I think the next 9 days are even more critical. I have some new intelligence to put out. I don't know how far you want to go into past work product to gain some authority for what I'm going to put out. Do you want
to? Well, here's what I'd like to do, Captain. Can you tell us just a little bit more about your background, since it's so long and storied, some really important points so our listeners know who you are? And
sure.
Then let's talk about that very interesting story about the Battle of Baghdad, what you uncovered.
Okay,
in those
let's
early
go ahead
days
and start
of
there then.
War.
You might say, folks, that I was spewed right out of the belly of the beast. I had a top secret clearance. Mr. Szymanski, Greg has said that I was in nuclear, biological, and chemical warfare when I was a young boy soldier at the 1st Cavalry Division. I instructed the nuclear, biological.
Test 1, 2, 3.
Are you there?
Yes.
I instructed the nuclear, biological, and chemical warfare course to the 3rd Corps NBC School from 1979 to 1980. Went to college, studied languages, was an honors student, came back out, went into military intelligence, became Russian fluent. Ya могу говорить сами по-русски, если вы хотите. Si quiere, yo puedo hablar español también. Multilingual, military intelligence, specializing in breaking down Soviet media, by the way. We used to always read it for encrypted and encoded messages as well as for political content. Even though it was controlled media, you could still fathom what was going on if you knew how to read between the lines. It was written in such a way and broadcast in such a way that informed people could read and listen between the lines. They have to have a communications vehicle. So what I'm going to do is largely based on my ability to analyze Soviet media. I've simply taken everything that I used to do in the Cold War that the good American people paid $1 million to teach me how to do, and now I'm doing it against the media that calls itself our media that is really nothing but a propaganda agency for the Bush regime. Now, after military intelligence, I came out of active duty in 1990. My most illustrious assignment, I suppose, was as an inspector translator for the Nuclear Intermediate Forces Reduction Team when they reduced the medium-range ballistic missiles in Europe. I came out and joined the 75th Division of the United States Army Reserve in Houston, Texas, and I was an OPFOR, an opposing forces specialist. And I spent 5 years doing tactical theater and street strategic war gaming, where we played out everything from, you know, me playing a division commander in the Russian army, simulating battle conditions in a computer simulation, all the way up to Dr. Strangelove kind of stuff, where we were doing simulations of theater and strategic level engagement. So I learned how to think both sides of the ball. In the army, we say, I can think blue. That means I can think like an American. And I could think red. And in those days, of course, that meant I could think like the Red Russian forces, the Red Army. My final assignment was as the public affairs officer for the 75th Division. I was on the general staff at that point. I know how inside politics work with the military-industrial system. I went to the public affairs course at Fort Benjamin Harrison, Indiana, graduated as the honor grad, and thereafter came out and started a career in media. I was the NBC affiliate writer for KPRC, NBC affiliate in Houston, Texas, spot wrote for the Wall Street Journal, regularly contributed to the Houston Chronicle, had ghostwriting clients all the way from Eckerd Pfeiffer, head of Compaq Computers, Ken Lay, of notorious reputation, Colin Powell, did a little spot writing for his purposes, wound up interviewing with Karen Hughes, the current media director for the Bush White House, about becoming Bush's speechwriter back in 1995, I think that 96. when he was the governor of Texas, and they were already looking at grooming him for a presidential run. So I know the Bush boys, I know the media, and I know the military inside and out at the highest levels and in its darkest recesses.
Well, let me tell you this. I'm glad you're on our side, Captain.
Well, I wish there were more like me and more better than me on our side, and I think there are. To tell your listeners how it was that I came out of what was a pretty good career as a ghostwriter, you know, rubbing elbows with the people in the right places, making a couple hundred bucks an hour when I was working, and I didn't have to work much at those rates. My needs were few. What I was doing was sitting back analyzing the pending war after 9/11, in which I was a true believer. I believed in bin Laden and al-Qaeda like I believed in Rudolph, Santa Claus, and the North Pole. They told me it was true. I believed it. In 2002, my best friend and best man, currently Ambassador Chase Untermyer to Qatar, who was formerly Assistant Secretary of the Navy, Chase Untermyer, under Reagan Bush, Bush 41, he knows that I tried to reactivate my commission and rejoin the services because I thought there was a war pending and believed fully in it. I believed the whole propaganda line. And I want to stress that. Just because people are subtle enough to read through Soviet lies or Korean lies or any kind of lies anywhere doesn't mean they look at their own side as a lying side. And that's a problem common to most people who are involved, no matter what their level of intellect or qualifications, in serving their country. They naturally assume that their country would never do nefarious, treasonable things. So that slowed me down. Where I woke up was in 2003. I was one of those few officers who went on record repeatedly saying that the Iraq war would turn into quicksand and we'd wind up losing the army there. Naturally, I was watching the war very closely as it began, as I suppose we all were.
And you still were a believer at this point, correct?
Say again?
You were a believer at this point in the government story and what government was doing.
I was a total believer in the government story on everything, except I thought they'd probably hype some of their claims about Iraq to get the public to go into it. It was clear the public was being arranged by a propaganda campaign to be taken into the war. I said that the move, one of my mentors was a German Wehrmacht officer, a captain from World War II, who also taught me ethics and art history, kind of a Da Vinci Code intellect, a brilliant man named Dr. Peter W. Gunther of the University of Houston. He and I analyzed the war plan and basically agreed that it was a German move into Russia. It was an Operation Barbarossa, and it was going to wind up being a bust. And that panned out. Not to go there too much, you know, clearly time has proven me correct on that. But I'm not happy about any of that. I'm not happy about anything that's wrong with my country. But I was watching the war very carefully as the U.S. forces neared Baghdad. Because understand, to a military man, an army crossing the line from Kuwait, the line of departure to go into Iraq, is like the football team getting the ball and starting to march down the field. I mean, I hate to compare war to sports, but why do you think we like sports? So taking Baghdad was like getting into the end zone, right?
Right.
Well, that night, the 4th of April, 2003, I just finished teaching a Taekwondo class. I'm a second dan, low-end expert, and I teach martial arts. I'd come home, and I was sitting there on the front, on the in front of the couch where my wife was sitting, and then all of a sudden she had the, we started hearing disconcerted, disjunct announcements coming from the Baghdad airport. People saying, oh, my God, you know, that was a bright flash. We didn't know that was coming. This is the CNN feed coming from Baghdad. And being a public affairs and a military intelligence officer, I knew very well that this was a choreographed, scripted war. And if they didn't know the flash was coming, it means the flash wasn't planned. It might have been the Iraqis attacking us or us counterattacking, but something had happened. That came from the airport. Within the next couple hours, Fox, CNN, whatnot, we start getting mixed feeds that they're reinforcements rushing to the airport. Now, reinforcements do not mean anything good, sir. So we're rushing people to the airport, and then the whole night goes by. There are mixed reports. Then suddenly the next morning, Saturday morning, April 5th, and this is where your listeners will probably pick it up, the media is telling us everything's cool. The president has just gone to see Tony Blair, I mean, to talk about fishing or ranching or whatever he talks about. The Pentagon has just decided to cancel its 12:30 p.m. Eastern press conference. And suddenly the biggest story in Iraq is not the Battle of Baghdad, which was raging the night before. It's Jessica Lynch, a cute blonde girl. So what they had done is they'd done what's called in the military, lifting and shifting the story. What had happened in Baghdad was such a disaster that the only story they could go with was a total psyop, a distraction story, Bush was going to Blair to discuss it, and the Pentagon was canceling its press conference until it could figure out how to handle it. So what we got for the next 3 days was Jessica Lynch. What we got at the end of that was the statue of Sodom falling. Folks, that's so you'd understand that Sodom had fallen. They did just that clumsy. They did a psyop. Now, at the time, we all bought it. I mean, well, most of us. I caught that one, but again, it was my field. So it was sold to the American public that somehow we had waltzed into Baghdad and nothing worth reporting had happened when nothing could have been further from the truth. What I found out later was that we'd been counterattacked by 5 regiments of Iraqi regular and Fedayeen forces at the airport. During the battle at the airport, which lasted 6 hours, the 37th Cavalry and elements of the 3rd Infantry Division came under such intense constant fighting conditions that they expended their ammunition. That wound up going to a neutron blast that
Captain,
night.
Can you hold that thought? We're going to have to take a break. We'll be back with Captain Eric May in 3 minutes on the Republic Broadcasting Network. Investigative Journal today, and we're talking to Captain Eric May, who says the next 9 days in the history of America could be critical. Watch out for nuclear attacks. Now, before we get into this story and all the information that Captain May has uncovered, we're talking about the Battle of Baghdad. You've uncovered some interesting information. Why don't you continue with that,
okay.
Captain?
We left it at an interesting point. After every break, I want to reiterate that any of your listeners who are hearing my voice, to refer to the documents. We've done extensive analytic and publishing work. To refer to all that, simply go to the Ghost Troop Bibliography. If you Google that if you search that through Google or any other search engine, Ghost Troop Bibliography. That's going to have everything that I'm talking about now broken down by categories so that you can click on icons and get to what you're interested in and want to work with. I think by the time we get to the 911, the nuclear 911 scenario, everyone will be interested in that. But to return to Baghdad for the moment, and by the way, nice Jethro Tull lead-in. I like that stuff.
Okay, thank you.
The Baghdad airport, the 37th Cavalry and elements of the 3rd Infantry Division, which were holding the Baghdad airport on the night of April 4th, morning of April 5th, that being Friday, Saturday, April 4th, April 5th in the States, came under intense attack from 5 regiments of Iraqis. They wound up in such an intense firefight that after 6 hours of battle, somebody somewhere committed to using neutron warheads. And what happened was that the Iraqis were fighting in the open and the Americans were fighting in tracks and tanks and BP in Bradley fighting vehicles. Apparently, they buttoned up and as what's called a final protective act, the final protective line, the Army went neutron. Now, you know probably, Greg, that since then the Army has revised its battle doctrine to make it much easier to go nuclear in tactical situations. They revised that as after the fact cover. But the fact is that they went nuclear with a neutron warhead. And for those of you who don't understand it, that means low blast, high radiation. The Russians may have said it best when they tried to get us not to deploy them to Europe. They said it's the perfect capitalist weapon. It destroys people and saves property.
Mm-hmm.
So neutron warheads were used. I did not publish that. You won't find that published in the reports as my bibliography, the Ghost Group bibliography, because I didn't confirm that until I was at Camp Casey Crawford this summer with Cindy Sheehan. I got that from a Marine who was there, an Army man who was there, and several Arabs who were there as journalists, observers, or whatnot. And that's common knowledge throughout the Middle East. It checks out multi-source with data I got involving things like decontamination of the Baghdad airport, bringing in truckloads of dirt and whatnot. So in any case, Baghdad went nuclear. At this point, we know why they covered it up. At that point, this being April 5th, 2003, all I knew was that they were probably using what was called OPSEC, Operational Security Protocols, because the fact of the matter is you don't want to have open news reporting in the middle of a battle when somebody's watching the TV on the other side of the line. That's understandable enough. So I waited about a week for the military to follow its correct protocols and release the story of what happened in Baghdad because that's public province. It was operational security during the battle, but afterwards should have been openly reported to the public as urgent war news. Remember, the public is sovereign. That's the theory of the American Republic. After a week of their not doing so, I filed a story with my editors at the Houston Chronicle calling for the president to explain himself or be impeached. You could say that's when I committed to the info war. After that, I went out and I took donations at my old college, the University of Houston Honors College, for 40 hours over the next 2 weeks, and I got $20. It was a dumbfounding to me that these kids who were the privileged elite of the United States didn't care enough about. And by the way, I wasn't going around saying there have been massive casualties, much more than they're reporting. I simply said people got hurt in the battle that was fought for Baghdad, which of course was the truth. And these people couldn't have given a damn less because right. The public had been inured to any kind of suffering. It had been tuned out, filtered out by the media as part of the propaganda effort. Well, after 2 weeks and the 40 hours in which I got $20, I decided that I would go out to Fort Stewart, Georgia, the home of the 3rd Infantry Division, and see what had happened. I went ahead and occasionally I do eccentric things. I took a 1,000-mile bicycle tour on my touring bike. I do those occasionally to kind of take the pulse of the country all the way across the Gulf Coast from Texas to Georgia. When I got there after 3 weeks of travel, I met with a Colonel Neil Dennington, a chaplain and former Special Forces soldier, then presiding over the Marin Chapel at Fort Stewart, Georgia. He confirmed that the 3rd Infantry Division and 37th Cavalry had sustained heavy casualties, that it was not being reported. He defended the decision of the Commander-in-Chief to cover up the constitutional protocols and violate the Defense Department's principles of information. He knew exactly what had been done wrong, and his only statement was that we're going to do everything wrong now and we'll get back to the law after the war's over. He told me in so many words that Special Forces detachments would be assassinating people like me who bucked the party line and that I was going to proceed at my own peril. After that, I came home to Houston, Texas, this being mid-May, and sat out for a month and a half until the 1st of July. And in July, the New York Times began to release stories about how women at Fort Stewart, Georgia, were complaining of receiving drug cocktails to keep them in line. And I'd already found out that there was some thugging and threatening going on. So now we had the despicable act of the wives and widows and the orphans and children of these brave patriots who had fought for their country for whatever causes being thugged and drugged to keep them into line.
Okay, Captain, let me take a break again. We'll finish up with this story and then get into the second part of your incredible story, very riveting, on the Investigative Journal.
You're listening to the Republic Broadcasting Network because you can handle the truth.
Since 1988, Herbal Healer Academy has been the global supply.
Okay, you're not going to hear the things that Captain May is telling you in school, that's for sure. And this story about Baghdad is upsetting. I mean, the military lost many, many more people, according to Captain May, and kept it from the American public, tried to harass the widows and orphans of the soldiers. Captain, have you ever figured out how many soldiers were not reported in the official death toll? Is that something that you researched?
I did analysis and estimation of between 500 and 1,000. That's the best I can come up with. There's a book about it, Thunder Run, which is referenced at the Ghost Troop Bibliography. Thunder Run was written by David Zucchino, L.A. Times embed with the 2nd Division, or rather the 2nd Brigade of the 3rd Infantry Division. And he reports heavy combat and intense emergency situations. But the numbers are censored out, and it's a propaganda piece. Of course, they nominated him for a Pulitzer for it. But because he did such a good job of telling it without telling it. So we estimate 500 to 1,000 that weekend in Baghdad. By the way, I'm again referenced Andrea Mitchell, MSNBC, July 2004, did an interview with David Zucchino where he said there were between 3,000 and 5,000. This is after Baghdad Airport. Remember Baghdad Bob said they'd killed 300 and taken it back?
Right.
Well, that's Arab propaganda. They'd only killed 200, and they hadn't quite taken it back at that point. So, you know, it was really bloody. Andrew Mitchell and David Zucchino were on air, and they put it between the lines again, but there were 3,000 to 5,000 people in prepared urban combat conditions waiting for the 3rd Infantry Division to do its thunder run, its charge into Baghdad. The Battle of Baghdad started at Baghdad Airport, and it went on 3 days. And of all conditions, I know this is a tactical intelligence officer, The last place any kind of mechanized infantry force wants to fight is in urban prepared conditions, where people are inside of gutters reinforced by concrete, brick walls, you know, everything, barricades. So it wound up being a bloody affray, and we got bloody too, is my understanding of it. That's another reason it's covered up, the sheer horror of the battle. But right now, to throw one thing in, since you asked body count, 500 to 1,000 Battle of Baghdad, that's my best estimate. But I'm getting from multi-sources, military and civilian. For example, Peter Phillips of Project Censors out of UCLA, or the University of California. We were this summer working with figures of 10,000 total killed in action soldiers of the 2,000 reported. Look, the people who cook the books for Enron and Ken Lay, it's the Bush people.
Right.
The same number game is going on. These are just number games. People don't know how many people died, and people say, well, why didn't the media pick it up? And the answer is because it's controlled. You call the media with a story, and you're liable to have the FBI on your store, on your doorstep.
Right. Exactly. They're right in with the government on this one.
Well, sure.
Is there anything else you wanted to finish up with the Baghdad story before we move on?
Leaving it at that point, on the 8th of July, I published a piece. Well, the 6th of July, Joe Wilson hit Bush in the New York Times with his famous op-ed attacking Bush for the false yellow cake evidence, you may remember.
Right.
He was retaliated against through his wife 8 days later. They outed Valerie Plame. David Kelly, weapons of mass destruction scientist in the UK, Dr. David Kelly, was talking to the BBC about trying to bust Blair for quote-unquote sexing up the evidence to go to war, something we know from the Downing Street memorandum is exactly what was going on. And God help him, he was making the mistake of talking to Judith Miller at the New York Times. I had gone on the attack against Bush here in Houston, which, of course, is his southern capital, by publishing an op-ed through my, at that point, still brave editors at the Houston Chronicle 2 days after Joe Wilson's piece, July 8, 2003, saying that Bush was basically a yellow lying dog, in polite terms, and reminding everybody again that I'd predicted quicksand and that's where we were. The three-week war had turned into an insurgency, and dollar-gallon gasoline wasn't coming. So I hit Bush hard. Now let's get what happened. Joe Wilson got retaliated against with his wife. David Kelly got assassinated on the 9th to the 17th of July at the exact same time that Blair and Bush were smiling at everybody and glowering at questions at a joint, when they had a joint appearance in front of Congress. And I had been underground when David Kelly died for 8 hours because I was contacted by media military associates and told I was on the list. So that was the first time I dived into the underground. For the next year until January 1st, 2004, I wrote 4 volumes of a congressional report about media military abuses, still using my credentials as they were as a journalist and a ghostwriter, and calling people at the top levels of media. That's referenced at the Ghost Troop bibliography, and anybody who wants to know all they need to know about how obtuse and unwilling and cowardly these journalists are, we call them prostitutes, to go to that report. That report concludes my first year work. Everything I told you I found out about Baghdad, I found out in the first year, except for the fact that it went nuclear that night. They didn't want us to know that because they didn't want the public to know they were willing to go nuclear. This was a nuclear war from the first month, and they didn't want
right.
the public to know that vital information. That
took okay,
me up
so...
to January 1st, 2004. At that point, I gave up working with the mainstream, and I gave up working with Congress and the military system. I announced that I was on a mission of conscience, and I decided to go ahead and found a cyber underground group known as Ghost Troop, which was made up of patriots like me who were former military or cyber journalists. And from then on, I didn't have anything to do with the media wars anymore. We went underground. Which brings us to the next big evolution in our Ghost Troop unit mission and analysis, if you want to get to the 911 stuff.
Yes, exactly. Why don't we move on? I'm just riveted to this, so just keep going.
Well, remember, it's been a three-year mission of conscience. The first year I stayed nice. I took the Bush boys on through their own mechanism, and at the end of the first year I knew the mechanism's broken. There is no branch of government. There is no reporting mechanism in the mainstream which is any longer functioning with any semblance of democracy. This is a Soviet totalitarianism, and everything I learned to evaluate the Russian structure works perfectly to evaluate what's happening now.
And I might add, you were a firm believer after 9/11 that our government was doing the right thing.
Like I say, I believed in bin Laden like I believed in Santa Claus. They don't.
Now, why? You told me the other night, you made this interesting analogy of why the American public, you kind of relate the American public to being a naive young bride. Can you tell us that?
Yeah, it's worth saying. It's rather like being a perfectly, you know, the public of America is very naive and innocent, and it's a beautiful thing. It should be cherished, not abused. But as with so many naive and innocent things, what's happened is they've got a horn dog named King George who's taken over the government. And in the same way that a naive and innocent young bride will never get, I mean, 100 hints that an old seasoned woman would know meant another woman was around will go unnoticed or easily explained away. Because naivete and innocence allow for exploitation. And what's happened is that the public has continually accepted these repeated assurances by Boy George, King George, same thing, that what's going on isn't an infidelity. But what's going on is high treason, and there's nothing like high treason to correspond to what we might call infidelity in a young marriage. The public has trusted this bridegroom, this president, especially because of an immediate crisis that came on. But all that has been nothing but an exploitation of youth, inexperience, and naivete by the president against the people. And
okay,
anyone, by the way, that I've talked to, and I've talked to a lot of international folks, always did. I was always doing that even when I was in the Army. It was my job. People from older countries tend to be kind of like people from old marriages. They're kind of past the idea that everybody's perfect, and they are much more willing to believe in treachery on the part of their leaders than we are. We're a new country, and we have a very, you know, I think it's a beautiful thing. I just think it's been horribly abused, our trust in government, especially in time of crisis. So let's go ahead and go on to how my eyes got opened, since I was one of those. When I say the American people are naive and innocent, well, in a lot of ways I ain't, but in my view towards my government, I always was. A soldier has to be.
Okay.
I got contacted in February of 2004 after being in the cyber realm specifically for about 2 months and having put up my first cyber publication, the Ghost Group Introduction, reference to the Ghost Group Bibliography, which your people should be going to. I got contacted by a Marine officer, United States Marine Corps Captain Jeff Cross, who had been, he told me, let me be clear. At this point, I'd heard rumors about 9/11 being an inside operation. I thought that was interesting, but I had no expertise in it, and I didn't take an opinion. I kind of was inclined to believe otherwise because the people who said it sound so disturbed, don't you know? They sounded agitated and disturbed. And
thank
that
you.
Always repulses people. So Jeff Cross got in touch with me, Captain Cross, Marine, and he told me in a conversation, you know, Captain May, I remember these little things. He called me Captain. Of course, he'd been a captain, but he was younger than I was. And he saluted my analytic work and my courage in following it up and everything. And he said, I've gotten in touch with you because you've got to be the kind of person who can do something about this. You know, you're a good officer. I was there. I was there, Captain. And it turned out that he'd been five blocks away from WTC 1 and 2 when 911 went down. And being a Marine officer, he'd made all kinds of analytic notes. He'd been inside his hotel room when it started, so he picked up the seismic tremors and, you know, he went out and he saw things, and he saw how federal people and media were acting, and he made combat notes. You know, this is what this man was trained to do. He's a good Marine.
Right.
And what he said as far as forensics, as far as procedure, as far as a million things that now make sense to me, none of that really mattered much because I was resistant. What mattered to him was the one thing he said that paralleled my experience, which was it didn't happen like they said it happened, Captain. And every time I tried to get in touch, they put me off, put me down, or tried to put me out of commission. Now, that rang a bell. So
yes.
I was very receptive to the idea that something funny was up about 911, and then came my epiphany. And we talked about this like last night. I think everybody, or the vast majority of people who have awakened to 911, had a moment of epiphany. Whether they can figure it out or not may not be the case, but I can. It was when the Madrid 2004 March 11th bombing occurred, the so-called European 911. When I discovered that from September 11th, 2001, 911-2001, to 311-2004 was exactly 911 days, all of my training as a, you know, a pretty high IQ guy for a soldier, I was an intelligence officer and multilingual, and I had a real good IQ as far as linguistics and decryption were concerned. That kept me up, and I started working numbers. And numbers were coming out that were so astronomically improbable And so astronomically coincidental, it was coincidence, that I very quickly stopped to believe any of this was a coincidence, and I began to realize the most fundamental thing about nations at war, and especially totalitarian nations, going back to my Soviet media training, which is to say encrypt signals into the open media. I discovered what we call in Ghost Troop the embedded code. And it goes back to what they do in media. They say that the media is going to be embedded. We remember they started calling media embedded at the beginning of the war. We may remember Walter Cronkite saying, I don't like that term. It sounds like the media has compromised itself. And that's exactly what it meant. Not only were they going to be embedded, therefore compromised with King George, kind of nasty sexual connotation that surrounds so much of what he does, not only were they going to be embedded with the military, therefore subject to its command, but they were going to embed the media with code, and the code was in large part numeric.
Hmm.
Working with that numeric code since then, we've been able to do extensive predictions. But probably I should say a few things about what it was about Madrid beyond just the coincidence of 911 days between 9/11 and 3/11.
Yeah, go ahead. Go ahead.
Well, 9/11, 2001, 3/11, Madrid, 2004, 9/11, 3/11, the 9 and 3 are square root and square of each other. There's another numeric coincidence. There was the strategically improbable point that the Spanish, who were having an election the next couple of days and wanting to swing it to the right, were saying that it was Basque separatists, ETA, you may remember, the ETA organization.
Right.
So they were calling it Basque separatists to help their right wing in Spain. And from the get-go, we were saying it was Al-Qaeda to help our right wing in the United States. Both countries were telling different stories on the basis of their temporary war needs. After the Spanish lost the election, the Spanish right wing lost the election, then they fell in line with the U.S. story and said, oh, yeah, it was Al-Qaeda. And then they blew the hell out of some guys in an apartment in Spain and said, well, we just killed them all. No need to ask any questions. So those are extremely suspicious. Then you get body count. Anytime you see a story, I'm going to teach your people from here on out to be crypto analysts and to watch stories. Body counts are contrived numbers. You can take a pile of hamburger and call it any number of bodies. And if you control the morgue, which ain't controlling a lot, you can put out the number you want. The body count from Madrid started out at 199. Now, that's the released figure. The interesting thing about that is 199 is a numeric inversion of the values of 911. 911, 199. So a little bit of manipulation there. After a week, the numbers went to 191, which is an anagram of 911, a mixing up of the order of the numbers. And not only that, but it represents eight people who got up off the mortgage slab and walked out of there. And that's impossible. So the code at that point, it was clear to me, was more important than reality. Somebody had slipped up, as they often do, by the way, when they do this. They're not perfect at it. They try to edit the errors out, but they don't get them in time. So you started having numeric improbabilities, and Ghost Troops, my unit, after I'd started working with a code, we started working with a story that came out at the same time as the Madrid bombing, which was that Al-Qaeda was promising a black cloud of death attack against a United States city that was 90% prepared. That story started coming out at the same time as the 3-1-1 bombing. So I started staying up nights doing encryption and started getting all kinds of signals. The Skull and Bones cult number, you may know, is 322. On 322, coincidentally, Fox News started floating a story that Al-Qaeda had gotten a nuclear weapon. Now, so, 322, Skull and Bones cult number, Al-Qaeda has the nuke. At this point, it was all clear that it was set up to me. The day before, 321, that was the assassination by Israel of Sheikh Yassin in outside of Palestine, which, of course, was to give Al-Qaeda the motive for placing the nuke that they got the next day. And these went on and on. There are pages and pages of notes, and there's a lot of stuff I've done in my online articles that goes through bibliography. But the sum of it was that as early as 3/11, I contacted the University of Houston FBI and Secret Service. Secret Service Agent Joyner on 3/12/2004. University of Houston Police Department, Lieutenant Rita Brazil, David Sarkozy and Warren McCall on 3/11. FBI, that was who asked for documents, Pasadena Police Department, University FBI Agent Gillette. Basically, I was playing it straight again because it was apparent to me that the target they were setting up was Houston. I can't get into all the encryption thing, but it became apparent to me that since Bush had been the governor down here, since Bush was an oil man, since Houston was sitting on top of all this oil stuff, And since the government had been filtering a story through the NSA, which, of course, now we know is nothing but a controlled asset, they'd been saying that Pasadena, an outskirt of Houston, was a target going back to 2002. So I
Captain, I'm going to have to interrupt you right here. We'll get right back to this after we take a three-minute break on the Investigative Journal. Okay, back for the final segment in this hour with Captain May, who's on the front lines here fighting the Illuminati, figuring out their embedded codes. And, you know, on the Illuminati dartboard, folks, Houston may be that bullseye, according to Captain May. This is incredible stuff, Captain, and I want to thank you for first coming on. And please tell us where we can read more about you and then get on with your story.
Okay, the best thing to do is go to Ghost Troop, GHOSTTROOP, Bibliography. That's a document we just produced that has all of our major categories of analysis and will take people into touch with all the work I'm describing here. If they want to join up with us and join our analytic product, I command an outpost at Ghost Troop Group. Just Google or whatever Ghost Troop Group, and that'll take you to our Yahoo page. If you want to be in, apply, and I'll examine you and bring you in. We're doing ongoing. We work open communications. We're above ground, and we're going straight at them, folks. It's the only way to take this bunch on. And by the way, when you say, Mr. Szymanski, that this is an Illuminatus crapola, you're exactly right. And I want to stress here, I don't believe a bit of this numerology stuff. I don't look at horoscopes. I don't do tea leaves. I don't read the tarot. But I can believe that other people believe every bit of that, and that's how I do it. I don't believe this number stuff. I believe they believe it. By 3-12-2004, one day after cracking the embedded code because of the Madrid stuff, where so many freak coincidences came in simultaneously, I began to make my first prediction that there would be a terror strike against the Houston Petrochemical Complex on 3-31-2004. I was progressively listened to and entertained as being a person of great interest by the local police authorities whom I went to first, and then the process began, starting with the FBI. The more I told them that made sense, the more anxious they became, and they went from trying to shut me out to trying to shut me up to trying to shut me down and wound up threatening me because I would not desist from making predictions and doing analysis of things that I knew damn well were good analysis because I'm not a freak or a loon. I'm a military intelligence officer. When I start talking code, I'm qualified to talk code. So they shut me down, particularly FBI agent Stolt in the Houston area. Shut me down with threats. At that point, on the 24th of March, 2004, I contacted Clear Channel, KTRH, Channel 740 AM, KTRH. Their news director was Tara Howard. I contacted her and basically gave her the same rundown I gave you at first. That intrigued her and alarmed her enough that she called up FBI National. FBI National realized that they were starting to get busted, and that's when they issued a Gulf Coast-wide terror strike alert against petrochemical refineries on the 25th of March, 2004. They said that it was on the basis of foreign, uncorroborated, unspecified intelligence, and it wasn't. The foreign, unspecified, uncorroborated intelligence was Captain May and Ghost Troop. They sanitized the scenario. Instead of giving our specific target date of 3/31, March 31st, they said it was something that might happen during the elections because Al-Qaeda wanted to interrupt them. But they did not want to get specific like we did. However, the area, police contacts of mine who were listening to me, particularly the Houston Police Department and the media, the next day went to a hush-hush, top-secret clearance, top-secret meeting the FBI held for media and cops in Houston trying to put down the alarm Ghost Troop had spread.
Okay, Captain, we're going to take a short break here. We'll be right back on the other side of this break with Captain Eric May on the Investigative Journal.